Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, veteran political journalist David Yepsen, returns to our program. David has just retired as host of Iowa Press. That's Iowa PBS's weekly public affairs program. He's hosted Iowa Press since the start of 2017. Kay Henderson, a familiar name to Iowa Public Radio listeners, has been named as David's successor. But David's connection with Iowa Press as a guest panelist goes way back to the late 1970s. He covered his first presidential campaign in 1976. For more than 30 years, he covered government and politics for the Des Moines Register. He's been a fellow at Harvard twice. A few years ago, he returned to Iowa after retiring as director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He joins us for this hour live. David, welcome back to the program. So good to have you.
It's good to be with you, Ben.
And I want to reach out to our listeners, your thoughts, questions, concerns about the past, present, or future of our politics for David to tackle. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, you have been a moderator of Iowa Press during tumultuous times. We can agree on that, David. Describe how you've seen your role as moderator in these hyperpartisan times with so much political history happening before our eyes.
Well, you're right. The times are very partisan, and moderating a debate is a challenge for anybody, whether it's at the local level or on at the presidential level. I often say the only losers in the debates are the moderators. Because everybody seems to be unhappy with their performance, but I see the role of the moderator as to first of all be moderate, try to make sure that people have a chance to answer questions and that they do answer questions and to try to conduct it in a civil tone. I think many of these debates tend to become shout fests where candidates talk over one another and. Try to one up one another, and it gets rather frustrating, and it turns off all viewers. People, it's just not very useful. And so, I think the moderator gives the candidates a chance to say their piece, a chance to respond to what the other candidate says, and then to try to focus on the most relevant issues. That are on the minds of voters. Mm-hmm. And if we can do that and at least think that candidates are treated fairly, then I think it's a successful debate. But it's a challenge.
Yeah, no doubt. Let me go through the spectrum. You'll recognize it when I sort of list it off. There's political spin. That's always been around. There are falsehoods. There are untruths. There are lies, downright, outright lies. How do you, as moderator, deal with those when you recognize them in your interviews or
well,
your debates?
In a debate, generally, the opposing candidate will challenge falsehoods. I think that a moderator has to be prepared to say, "Well, you understand, Congressman or Congresswoman, that the scientists say that that's not correct. You at least." State you can't get it become a participant in the debate yourself, but you do need to point out or in obvious cases people are saying things that are just scientifically untrue, and that's a challenge in today's debates. American politics has changed, and that's reflected in our debates in the old days, and I'm talking about pre-1994 basically. Candidates would run for office by diving to the right if you were a Republican or diving to the left if you were a Democrat, but then moving back to the center to try to attract independent votes after the primary or the nomination and in the general election contest. And that has started to change after the mid-90s. Candidates in both parties decided it was better to gin up your base of support, to turn out your core supporters in record numbers, and then secondarily to try to diminish or suppress the turnout of the other side. And that has led to some pretty negative politics, red meat politics, waving the bloody shirt politics. And on top of that, then here in the most recent years, you've had the arrival of social media, in which doing that, driving up your base, driving down the base of the other side, is done on Twitter and Facebook and through social media. And finally, through the fracturing of the media audience by various cable outlets. You add all that together, and we have a very toxic situation in our democracy. And frankly, I'm worried about it because we don't have the traditional democratic dialogue, small d, democratic dialogue. We argue over the littlest thing, all in an attempt to drive up your turnout and discourage the turnout from the other side.
Here's an email, David, from one of our listeners, Dirk. This may overlap with a bit of the answer that you gave a moment ago, but let me just voice Dirk's concern here. Mr. Yepsen regularly gave a platform on Iowa PBS to elected officials and other public figures to continue to spread their conspiracy theories around issues like voting safety, vaccines, water pollution, and climate denial. Were there editorial meetings to discuss this practice, and how did they come I assume he writes to make the choice, I think, is what he meant here.
Well, we're a public affairs news program, and so part of our responsibility to Iowa viewers is to bring Iowa political leaders to the fore. And when if someone was starting to engage in truly false comments, you know, I think it was our responsibility to point that out. But frankly, we would get politicians who would say they have concerns about vaccines, but I don't think we got the sort of the anti-vaxxing rhetoric that you see on placards today. We always do editorial meetings where we script out our questions and what we want, what kind of news we expect to see made, what sort of issues are front and center, what do people care about. So I think if someone wants to come on and spread something that reasonable people are considering to be false, we have to say that and let them give them a chance to respond to that criticism. It's not our place to get argumentative or shouting with guests, but I think you leave the viewer with the clear knowledge that what this person just said, there are people, reasonable people who disagree with that and think it's factually untrue, and then we should move on to something else.
Also with a claim, and I don't know if you've had guests on Iowa Press who've done this, a false claim that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. Have you had that instance?
No, I don't recall that. We were Republicans who were saying we need to get to the bottom of this, but it's my recollection. We did ask, do you believe Donald Trump won the election? And eventually,
Oh, David, are you still there?
Tough for Republicans.
Yeah.
Pardon?
You dropped out a moment. If you're in a cell phone area, maybe I don't know if you moved your position wherever you are with perhaps a cell phone.
All right.
Dropped out.
Am I coming through now?
Yeah, you're just fine there, David. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
All right. We had Republicans who said they were troubled by the results, that they were concerned with the accuracy of the count. Eventually, I think, I'm trying to think back through our Republican guests, they would all say, yes, Joe Biden won the election and Donald Trump lost. They didn't necessarily like saying it, and maybe they didn't put it that way, but that's just factually incorrect. But there are a lot of people in that Republican base who want to argue with that, and the facts are the facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What have you found most interesting in how the major political parties have dealt with the January 6th riots? Truly historic, this violent attempt to prevent the peaceful transfer of power to a new president. And what's preventing the two parties from coming together in a national interest to get to the bottom of it to prevent anything like that from happening again?
Well, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. The function of each party is to do things to drive up their base and core supporters and to do things to discourage the other side. So I think Republicans who enjoy a lot of support from ultra-conservative activists really don't want to do anything to discourage them or make them angry. And more importantly, they don't want to do anything to alienate former President Donald Trump himself, who is a very influential figure inside Republican circles. And so they try to walk a very, very fine line trying to make everybody happy.
Right.
And so I think that's a big part of what occurs. But generally, I think Iowa Republicans at this point say, what happened was wrong, and we need to move beyond that. Or as Democrats would say, we need to get to the bottom of it. And so that's, again, the two parties that line up on different sides.
Yep. David Yepsen, our guest this hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Or email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Ross, one of our listeners, Ross, asking, will Governor Reynolds' poor response to COVID cause her to lose the election? Ross judges her response, obviously, to be poor. Polls show that Governor Reynolds is enjoying favor with those many Iowans who are in favor of what she's done during this pandemic.
It's a good question. It's probably the question on the minds of a lot of people. Right now, I would guess that Kim Reynolds' job approval rating is low. She was right at 50% back in the spring. There's not been any good reliable polls since that time. But the way she acts and the way she campaigns, you can tell she is trying to fire up that Republican base, do things to diminish Democratic support. So I think Reynolds and Republicans are concerned. But it's also true that almost every governor in the country is having some version of this problem, Republican or Democrat. It's tough being a governor now. You're having to do very unpopular things. You're having to lead. And there's just no way to make everyone happy with mandates and closures and all that, the masks, very difficult for any governor, Republican or Democrat, to lead at this point. Now, that said, I mean, obviously Kim Reynolds has to be considered vulnerable, but I think this state is trending Republican. And the old adage of politics is you can't beat somebody with nobody. Mm-hmm. And so you have to ask, who are the Democrats going to field? That's yet to be decided. But there's going to have to be a formidable candidate, and it's going to have to be somebody who's well-financed. And right now, I don't see that on the horizon. But this is very early. We're over a year away, so we not get too predictive. But I know that just from talking to Democratic strategists, they're worried if they're going to be able to pull this off. Iowa's trending Republican. Republican voter registrations are up, Republicans are doing a better job of finding those core voters who've not been voting in non-presidential years.
Yep.
So she's vulnerable, but no predictions. Can it be somebody with nobody?
For years, David, Iowa was considered a purple state. For most of the decades that you have been covering Iowa politics, we had Senators Grassley and Harkin there on the two different sides of the political spectrum, albeit moderates. Now Iowa more in the Republican column. Donald Trump winning Iowa the past two elections, both times by nearly 10 points. What has been driving it? What has changed Iowa politics? Or what have the Iowa Democrats done wrong?
It isn't just Iowa. I think much of rural America has shifted toward the Republican Party. You see this happening in Missouri and in Arkansas and in Iowa, certainly. You see it in voter registrations. You see it in the outcome of statewide races in those states. And that's just part of the trend. Rural America generally is become more conservative and more Republican.
But why? The Democrats, did they miss some boat there, some message not connecting? How?
I think their message has became too left of center for many people. I think there are cultural changes in America that worry people in rural America. The country is becoming more diverse. The Democrats and Democratic solutions that require an activist government don't go over very well in rural America. Rural Americans are very independent. So on subject after subject, climate change, environment, law enforcement, even on abortion rights, the rural America has moved to the right. And, you know, that's caused a problem for Democrats everywhere. I mean, in states, you know, like West Virginia, for example, Democratic governor, he became a Republican. So I think that's all, it's not specific in Iowa, but I think it's Democrats having a message that just doesn't resonate with many rural Iowans.
Political
or rural Americans.
Political journalist David Yepsen with us this hour. If you've just joined us, we have, David, a number of people lining up on our phones to ask a question. I'll ask our callers, in the interest of getting as many in as possible during this hour, to be brief with your comment, your question for David. We can get more people in. Let's go to Steve. Steve is with us in Iowa City. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thanks. I'm glad to be with you. David, I wanted to remind you of a conversation that you and I had about 35 years ago that you won't remember, but it always stuck with me. I was an intern reporter at the Des Moines Register and working on a weekend and assigned to cover this senator from Delaware named Joe Biden, who was coming to speak to a living room full of people in Windsor Heights at a John Rorick fundraiser. Do you remember any of that?
Steve, do you have a question?
Oh, yeah. It was very funny because I couldn't figure out why. And I asked Mr. Yepsen, whom I didn't get to speak with that often. I said, you know, what's Joe Biden doing in Windsor Heights? And David said, well, he's probably going to be back in a couple of years. And he was. And it didn't work out for him then. But obviously he kept coming back and it did work out for him. And I just always remember David's wisdom. He was a great guy to work around, even though we weren't really on the same level at the Des Moines Register. Thanks for the time.
Steve, thank you for that story. I don't know if you had a reaction to that, David. Certainly Joe Biden run for president more than once, and he has a super long political career. David Yepsen, are you there still?
Yes, I'm there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Sorry about the continued difficulties. Go ahead.
I remind people that many presidents get to the White House on their second or third go. And so it is it, just because we're seeing candidates now in 2024 who've run before, who are showing up in Iowa. And, you know, an Iowa political reporter knows that, if you know, there's more, it never ends in this state. And if they're here now and they'll be back in 4 years.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. Tom is with us in Des Moines. Thanks for waiting, Tom. You're on the air with David Yepsen.
Yes, thank you very much. Long-time listener, sometimes caller. I suffer from a little cognitive dissonance in listening to David say that in a manner of complaint, it seemed that, you know, that, and I hear this from a lot of journalists, that the two parties are too polarized. And I believe with all my heart that if we had a common basis of facts, then the polarization would shrink a good bit. And it's the duty of journalism, and this is where I want to get into David's field here, is journalism. And I think the duty of all journalists, and in his case, the Iowa Press Program, it should be fact airing. That's what I think the mission of his program is. In the fact airing segment of journalism, as well as all others, should be to get the facts out there. And if we had more challenging of Republicans who seem to be the biggest problem in terms of facts, you know, Donald Trump's the big lie. And a few months ago, you had Mike Nagle on your program. And his facts about water pollution in the state were not properly challenged, I don't believe, by your program.
Okay.
I think that you need to do more of that.
Right. Very good. We got the message loud and clear. A little criticism for me and for David there. So talk about this, David, here. You know, when to challenge facts as a moderator, especially when you're doing something live. Fact-checking in real time is a challenge for any moderator. But I know you covered a little bit of what Tom had to say there before, but perhaps you want to add to it.
Well, Mike Nagle believes that the state's system right now of trying to combat water quality is working. There are people in the environmental community who do not believe it's working. I think it's my job as a moderator and in that show to air both sides and to let them have their say, and then let people make their own judgment. We don't have a mass media like we used to have, where if Uncle Walter Cronkite said something, it was true, and we could all agree about that, the facts, and then argue over whether we should go, where we should go. Now it is the media is much more fractured, and so Mike Nagle is a Republican. He's got a rural base. He wants to fire up that base, and that's why he says what he does and what he believes, and he doesn't believe he's misleading people. The environmental community wants to disagree with him on that. The water quality issue is a huge issue in this state, and it gets pretty technical pretty quickly. So I think the best that a journalist can do is to try to point out both sides or other points of view and allow Mr. Nagle to respond. It's also true that in the course of that show, we have had people from the environmental community, Neil Hamilton, for example, who voiced other concerns. Sometimes you have those people on together and you have a debate that can result in a shout fest, which isn't very useful to anybody. Or you can have them on separately, have them make their say, challenge them on their points, and the viewers can make up their own mind.
So glad to have David Yepsen with us, political journalist, this hour, just retired as host of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. And we're going to be back after a short break to field more of your calls, perhaps follow up, talk about the Electoral College, the way in which the major parties have changed in the decades that David has covered them. We'll be back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with David Yepsen in just a moment.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, political journalist David Yepsen. He's been covering politics since the 1970s. His first presidential campaign that he covered, 1976. Just retired as host of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. More than 30 years he spent at the Des Moines Register covering government and politics there. This hour, reviewing and taking your questions. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. David, before we go back to callers, emails, I want to ask you about the Electoral College. Democrats especially unhappy because of the Electoral College over the last few years. Minority rule has become a more prominent feature of our American politics. in 2000 and also again in 2016, the presidential candidate who received fewer votes than the opponent who was sent to the White House. Joe Biden's victory, even in 2020, came not because he won nearly 7 million more votes nationally than President Trump, but rather because he won, say, 200,000 votes more in a handful of swing states. So also similar complaints about Congress, where Republican senators make up the majority of the chamber, even though they represent more than 20 million fewer Americans than Democratic senators do. What is your thought on the unrest about the Electoral College, the way our system works? Can this last?
It goes back to the founding of the Republic and large states and small states. The small states were worried about being overwhelmed by the large states, and they had the Great Compromise, created the U.S. Senate on area and the House on population. And the Republicans, after the Civil War, added rural states, all of us states with squares west of here, who they knew were going to elect more Republicans. That goes back a long way. The problem has gotten more pronounced as we've become more partisan. We were talking earlier about rural America becoming more Republican, and that, given the skew that is in the Electoral College because of the skew in the Senate, it's here to stay. And I don't know of any quick solution. One thought that I have had is that perhaps you could create better elections by allocating electoral votes on the basis of which candidate wins a congressional district. It's a system they have in Nebraska and in Maine, and it does change the nature of the campaigns. More, it would create more toss-up. Instead of 8 or 9 toss-up states, you'd have maybe 100 toss-up districts. But even there, experts will tell you that they don't think that make much difference in the outcome of the election. So the short answer is, if you want to be president, the system requires you to get a lot of votes in a lot of different places.
Let's go back to our phones. Bill is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Bill.
My question has to do with fake news. What impact is the fake news phenomena having on the news media and their reporting of politics? And then second, what impact is fake news having on political campaigning?
Good question. Bill in Des Moines, thank you.
Fake news requires journalists, mainstream journalists, to talk about more facts and try to respond to it, to do fact-checking, to write stories about it. Most mainstream news organizations are doing that. There are many people who do not get their information from mainstream news, and it goes back to what we were saying earlier. The electorate has become fractured, and many people don't rely on the mass media to get information. They rely on niche media that tends to reinforce their biases, and social media, which is really not very social anymore, and has become a source of real division in our society. And so it's a problem. And the only thing I think journalists can do is to keep what we've already tried to do, and that is to point out what the truth is and write about the accusations that are made. Even there, people criticize us because we are giving airtime and space in newspapers to fake news, to falsehoods, and that we shouldn't even do that. So it's a good question, and there's no easy answer.
Right, and David, comment on this. Fake news means different things to different people. Your answer led me to believe you interpret it as literally news that is fake, that is untrue. But some politicians will wield that sword in the other direction, call anything they disagree with fake news, right?
That's correct. And President Trump was famous for that. And, I think over time, with enough voters, that wore a little thin. And so Joe Biden was able in some of these battleground states to tip enough votes away from Trump and to Joe Biden that enabled President Biden to win.
Let's go back to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Pat is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Pat. Thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Thank you. David, can you tell us about some of the colorful characters from the press that you have had to brief, going all the way back to Johnny Apple in 1976? I also mentioned David Broder and T.R. Reid of the Washington Post, and possibly others from the foreign press. If you're able to give us an impression of one or more of those in your interaction with them about the Iowa caucuses.
Thank you, Pat, in Des Moines.
Well, you mentioned Johnny Apple from the New York Times, and he was one who reporters love to visit with because he had a big expense account, and he loved to eat. And so he could, when he would come to Iowa, he'd want to go talk politics, but find some nice restaurant to do it in. And so he enjoyed life and food, and he certainly liked the cuisine here in Iowa. Most of these reporters, you'd come in contact with them, and they were dropping in, visiting, you know, trying to get a handle on what was happening in this state, where to go, people to see. Today, national journalists are much more fluent, if you will, and knowledgeable about Iowa. And so you just really you don't have those, they call them big feet, having the influence that they once had. But Johnny Apple is a very colorful man.
Okay. David, what are your thoughts about the current tension? It seems unprecedented to me. You go back much further than I do in your political studies, research, and reporting. The current tension, battles between levels of government, particularly over COVID health public policies, their mask and vaccination mandates, federal government feuding with states, states feuding with communities within the states.
Well, you know, the argument over between freedom and the needs of the community, I mean, really goes back a long ways in our society. And it has always pitted Americans who want to be left alone or libertarian types with those who say we owe responsibilities to the community. It goes back to the kinds of people that settled this country and the reasons that they came here. And so here now it's flaring up over the wearing of masks, which is factually a good thing to do if you want to suppress COVID. But there are people who do not want to wear them. And so, you know, how coercive should government be in trying to force people to comply and wear masks? You see this in other areas, motorcycle helmets, safety belts in cars. There are some people who are just, you can call them ornery, but they tend to believe that, you know, they're free to do this. And others say, and I think rightfully so, that their freedom ends at the tip of my nose. And it's a great debate, and it has ebbed and flowed in this country, and I imagine it will continue for some time. And I think public opinion has started to shift against, for example, some of the anti-vaccine people now that we're seeing the hospitals load up with people who have not gotten vaccinated, and this is putting the real pressure on the healthcare system. I think public opinion has shifted there some. And, you know, you may have a right not to have a vaccine, but you don't have a right to be going around making other people sick. And so that's going to be where this debate goes, I think, in the next few weeks particularly.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we would have had the debate, the divide, such as it is today, had Donald Trump not become president?
Well, I don't know. That's hard to say. I think President Trump and some Republicans were a little slow to recognize this, the severity of this, because it went counter to the narrative that they wanted to sell, which was that things were going great in the country. Mm-hmm. And they were worried about depressing the economy. I think you know, some Republicans today even are concerned about doing anything to jeopardize the growth of the economy. And you, as a result, you have the governor, for example, saying this is just going to have to be something we try to live with. It's going to be part of our life going forward. Well, a lot of people will reject that. And so let's have the debate and the gubernatorial campaign in 2022.
Mm-hmm. At the legislative level, the Iowa legislature, governorship, what are you finding most interesting in the recent past in the realm of state politics?
Well, we're seeing the growth of suburban Iowa.
particularly around Des Moines and around the Cedar Rapids area. And so we'll be watching the redistricting that's going to come out in a few days, the redistricting plans, to see how that changes. More immediately, tomorrow, we have a special election for the Iowa House in Ankeny. It's one of the largest districts now in the state because of the growth of the suburbs. Republicans have a good candidate, so do Democrats. President Trump carried it by about 1 point. Democrats would love to win it to prove that they can attract votes in suburban Iowa, particularly with women. But Republicans, frankly, we talk a lot about suburbs. Republicans, they do well enough in the suburbs, and they get a lot of votes from evangelicals who live in the suburbs. So that's something for everybody to watch, is a special election in Ankeny, because I think it will have a big effect on morale in the Democratic Party and their ability to recruit candidates around the state.
Mm-hmm. Republicans obviously having great success in Iowa, unified control of both chambers as well as the governorship for several years now. What are Democrats doing wrong, if I can put it that way, or what do they need to do in order to have a chance of let's just stick with the legislature, getting back a majority in one or both of the chambers?
Well, the first thing is they'll get a benefit from redistricting. That will shake up the district lines enough that perhaps some Republicans will retire, will create more open seats, and that gives Democrats an opportunity. I think Democrats will tell you they made a big mistake in not going door to door in the last election. Republicans did. That was a mistake. I think there was a mistake there in Johnson County. A lot of Democrats, a lot of people voting for Joe Biden who did not bother to vote in the race for Congress. It meant the election of a Republican to Congress. So they've got some work to do on a number of fronts.
Any mistakes having to do with the racial and social justice protests of 2020 there, as far as messaging from the Democrats?
That's correct. I mean, they got hung with this defund the police rhetoric, and, you know, it really backfired against them. And Republicans exploited that advantage. You know, Democrats don't talk that way, but, I mean, they were certainly blamed for a lot of that. And so Democrats have to be careful of that messaging. They made some messaging mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Back to Congress, the midterms coming up in just over a year. What do you have, David Yepsen, your eyes on when you consider the midterms? And granted, we already mentioned there's eons of time before that election. A lot can happen. But from our vantage point at this point in time,
well, I think right now we're watching to see what Cindy Axne does in this district. She has the decision to make about running for re-election or possibly running for governor. She's waiting to see what this redistricting thing looks like. Her district here in central Iowa is likely to get smaller, and it's likely to get maybe even become more Democratic. She's under pressure to run for re-election because Democrats need to hold the seat. But it's likely the Democrats will lose control of the House. I think statistically, a president with the low job approval rating that Joe Biden has right now, his party will lose about 34 seats in Congress. So it is a long way away, but history is against the Democrats. And so that raises the question whether Cindy Axne wants to try to run for governor. I think she'd be a formidable candidate. Republicans are worried about that. She's well-known, could raise money. That we'll have to wait and see what redistricting does. And then I think a lot of dominoes all over the state are going to fall. Some people will quit. Other people will run for office, and we'll see new faces, and there'll be a big turnover. And that'll be an interesting story to follow here in Iowa, the growth of the suburbs, new faces.
Mm-hmm. Do you have every confidence that the redistricting will be carried out? It's in the hands of the committee right now in a way that both major parties deem as fair?
Yes, I do. I know that many Democrats are concerned that Republicans will follow the law until they can get a redistricting plan that they can change. I guess I don't sense from Republicans that they want to have to go that far. Republican state chairman pointed out one time on our show, you know, why would we want to change the rules of a game that we've just won? And so I guess I
I don't think that it will come to that. But in this environment, anything's possible. I just don't think Republicans need to go that far in order to maintain control. The thing that's key in Iowa in winning races to the legislature is the recruitment of a good candidate. And the sooner you get district lines set, the sooner both parties, each party, can go about trying to find that candidate who can run and win and do well. So that hasn't changed. And so I think we'll just have to wait and see what the redistricting is. But the director answered your question is, I don't expect Republicans to try to gerrymander.
Mm-hmm. Springing over 2022 to 2024, of course, Donald Trump has a considerable following. He's making all kinds of moves, like he's going to be officially declaring for 2024. Considerable political influence he has over GOP leaders in Congress. Your questions at this point about 2024?
Well, obviously, is he going to run again? I think he is. I think if he does, he sort of clears the field. It'd be very difficult for Republicans to stop him from getting the nomination if he wants it. Now, for some reason, he doesn't run. Then I think it's a battle for who's going to inherit his mantle. His impact on the Republican Party has been enormous, and whether it's President Trump or any number of other Republicans, they're going to be taking his mantle and his message, and we've got ringside seats in Iowa. The 2024 Republican caucus campaign is underway early as candidates start to show the flag, and you know they're essentially telling Iowa Republicans, keep me in mind if this thing opens up. If Trump runs again, I expect most of these candidates will fold. And I suppose there'll be some question of whether somebody could find a way to embarrass Trump in a primary somewhere, you know, like Gene McCarthy did with Lyndon Johnson in 1968. But frankly, I think if Donald Trump wants to be the Republican nominee for president and announces he clears the field.
Mm-hmm. How confident are you that the Iowa caucuses in 2024 and beyond will have the political weight that they've had in the past? After 2020, of course.
Yeah, I think on the Republican side, I think they will continue to be important. On the Democratic side, I do think there's now a legitimate question to be raised about whether the Iowa Democratic caucuses are useful for the National Democratic Party. The function of a party is to win a presidential election. The Democratic path to 270 electoral votes no longer runs through Iowa as it did for the last few decades. And Democrats might, in fact, be better off to move their nominating contest to states like Wisconsin, Georgia, Nevada, and to do all of that organizing and all of that candidate activity that can then pay off in delivering a close state election in November. They look at all the effort they put in here, and I think national Democrats are going to be saying, hey, it was great while it lasted, but we've got to move our process on to some other state.
Mm-hmm. And so we could see the National Democratic Party abandoning Iowa Democrats in this. Is that a prediction you want to make? Or?
Well, I don't know if I want to go that far, but I certainly can understand it, and I think it's a legitimate question for Democrats to be asking themselves. I mean, the function of a political party isn't to create events that fill Des Moines restaurants and hotels. It's the function of a political party is to nominate winning presidential candidates. And you win presidential races by getting 270 electoral votes. Everything you do is secondary to that goal. And the Democrats need to do things in Arizona, Wisconsin, Nevada, Georgia, in order to win 270 electoral votes in 2024. The question is whether Iowa is really contributing anything to that.
Okay, we have just a few seconds left. David Yepsen, time enough to tell us what's in your immediate future after your retirement from Iowa Press.
Well, I want to do a little travel, and I've got a lot of books I need to get read. So I'll be curled up in front of the fireplace.
Oh, that sounds good. Once our weather cools down a bit more than it has. David Yepsen, thank you so much for being on. We look forward to having you on the program again. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Yepsen, political journalist, retiring last week as host of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. River to River, today produced by Zachary Oren Smith. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, neurologist and sleep disorders expert Dr. Eric Dykin. He'll address the mysteries of the restless leg syndrome. Also, new research that shows that sleeping too much or even too little could have a negative impact on the brain. We'll talk about that tomorrow on the program. Until then, I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.